Drink in the shoulder. All right, ladies. Up, 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 up.
This is Jason Albert, and you are listening to Nordic Nation from Faster Skier. In this episode, we talk with Peggy Shin, the author of a new book, World Class, The Making of the U.S. Women's Cross-Country Ski Team. Shin's book was released in February, a few days before Shin herself jetted off to Pyeongchang, South Korea to cover the Olympics. Not one to miss a good show, Shin was able to see the U.S. ski team come full circle as Jesse Diggins and Keegan Randall won gold in the Olympic team sprint. Shin's book, World Class, The Making of the U.S. Women's Cross-Country Ski Team, is our primary topic of discussion. From the roots of the women's team when Marty Hall and John Caldwell pulled the strings to the modern World Cup, where the U.S. women's team has become a force, Shin gives us a glimpse into how the women's program went from deep grassroots to Olympic gold. Our interview with Shin went down after 3 weeks in Korea when, admittedly, faster skiers Gabby Naranja and I, as well as Shin, were feeling brain dead. So pardon any giddiness or digressions. We're sitting here in the main press center here in Pyeongchang. This is me, Jason, and we got Gabby.
Here I am.
And can you introduce yourself, please?
I'm Peggy Shin. I write for TeamUSA.org, and I just wrote a book on the women's cross-country ski team.
And what's the name of that book?
It is called World Class, The Making of the U.S. Women's Cross-Country Ski Team.
Where can people get this?
People can order it on Amazon, or they can order it, ask their local bookshop. I always try to push local bookshops to order it. Or you can go to the University Press of New England website, which is upne.com, and order it there.
Yeah, so where are you from? And just a little bit of, before we get into the details of the book, you know, just how you're involved with skiing and how you actually really kind of developed a passion for exploring this women's team.
Okay, so I currently live in Rutland, Vermont, but I was raised in northern Vermont in Lindenville. I have to say, though, that I was not born in Vermont. I was born in New Haven, Connecticut, and we moved to Vermont when I was three. My mom is a seventh-generation Vermonter, and I'm an eighth-generation Vermonter. My great-great-great-great-great-grandfather settled East Hardwick, came to Vermont before Vermont was a state.
Wow.
So my dad took a job at Linden State College when I was three. He was an English professor. And we moved to Lindenville. And my mom grew up skiing because she was raised in Cabot, Vermont. She was one of the early people hiking up Mount Mansfield. So, you know, as soon as I could walk, of course, my mom put me on skis in the backyard. So I just grew up skiing. And I grew up alpine skiing. Cross country as a kid, I didn't like it because I didn't like breathing hard. And the first time I went out,
that's
they
like
didn't
a good normal kid.
Yeah. They didn't give me any ski poles when my first time cross country skiing. They gave me no ski poles, and I'm trying to get up a hill with no ski poles. Like, that was not a nice thing to do. But I discovered cross country skiing in high school when I was trying to stay fit for rowing. I went to prep school in New Hampshire, so I cross country ski in the winter, and then I became a bike racer. It was cross country skiing in the winter to stay fit for that. So I have had a kind of a convoluted career. I got sidetracked into science, so I have this master's degree in engineering, but I really always wanted to write. But my sister told me I couldn't write because that was what she did, and she's older. So finally, when I was 32 years old, my husband said, "Why don't you write? Why don't you quit this, what you're doing, and move back to Vermont?" I was in Colorado at the time. "We'll get married, and you can write." So I moved back to Vermont, and the Rutland Herald needed a ski writer. So I thought, well, this is better than making cookies and bonbons in a farmhouse in Vermont all winter. So that started in 1997. And as part of that, I had to cover the college carnival circuit. And the college carnivals are half alpine, half Nordic. So I liked covering the alpine skiers, but I loved covering the Nordic, the cross-country skiers, because nobody gives them any press. And I loved getting to know them, and I loved getting to know. It was the early 2000s, so the Europeans were still doing much better than the Americans. So I got to watch that progression of the American athletes, like Glenn Randall, finally, like, you know, winning NCAAs and how big of a deal that was. And then when Sophie was part of the Dartmouth UVM podium sweep in 2012, I mean, I got to witness all of that. So when these women, like Sophie and Ida and Rosie, particularly because they were on the Dartmouth team, when they started skiing World Cups and started doing well, because I'd followed them from when they were little kids, I was like, how is this happening? So there was that first relay in the Czech Republic in 2012, February 2012, when they finished fifth. And that, I remember waking up in the morning and seeing that and going, whoa, what just happened? Did they like find the greatest wax ever? You know, what happened? What caused that? And I called them up, and each one of them credited teamwork. And that blew me away, because as a kid growing up in Lindenville and being on the Linden Institute cross-country running team and track team and ski team, and then going to prep school and being on those teams, every team I had been on, we tore each other apart. There was a coach who was only interested in the top skier or the top rower. The rest of us were sort of forgotten about. You were jealous of your competitors. You weren't encouraged to learn from them, and the diva or the best person on the team was sort of pulled aside on their own little special training program. So I couldn't fathom that teamwork would help anybody. To me, teamwork, I mean, I shied away from teams. I trained with men on my own because that made me a better athlete, and I wasn't with a bunch of women who were trying to claw my eyes out. So the fact that these women were crediting teamwork, I thought there was more of a story there. So that sort of is a long story of how the book came to be.
Okay, so the book in particular, tell us again what the title is.
World Class, The Making of the U.S. Women's Cross-Country Ski Team.
Okay, so it sounds like you start the book off with kind of a hallmark relay in 2012. Can you talk a little bit about that and why that's notable?
Okay, so from this relay in February 2012 in the Czech Republic where they finished fifth, so the next season in November 2012, so what is that, 7 months later, 8 months later, they're in the first or second World Cup of the year. It's in Gällivare. I don't know if I pronounced that right. Sweden.
That sounded good.
And there's a relay. And they fielded a team. They were kind of excited because they'd finished fifth, and maybe they could finish fifth again. And if you listen to the Eurosport telecast of that relay on YouTube, it's hilarious because the Eurosport guys are like, oh, it'll be a fantastic result if they finish in the top five, these Americans. And you watch them, and like Holly Brooks is the leadoff leg, and she crosses the line in eighth, and she tags off to, who was the second?
Gosh, well.
It wasn't Ida. Ida couldn't do it, and it was Liz, and maybe it was Keegan. It was Keegan.
We can look that up, too.
And Keegan, I wrote about it, I should remember, but I'm kind of brain dead right now.
So
this
is where I have our disclaimer. I've been here 3 weeks. You've been here
3 weeks.
3 weeks. 2 weeks. We're toast.
Yes. I can't remember anything. I can't remember my birth date. I don't know what day it is back home.
It's tomorrow.
No, it's yesterday back home.
Like that. Oh, yeah.
I just checked in for my flight that says it's today. I keep double checking.
Maybe I need to do that. So do you want to look that up? Or
no, it's Keegan.
Okay.
So she hands off to Keegan, and Keegan pulls them up to the Norwegians and the Swedes, who are off the front. And then you see Liz. She tags off to Liz in the first freestyle leg, and Liz just skis like she's possessed. And she is just a couple seconds behind Norway. It's like, oh my gosh, they're going to finish on the podium. And then she tags off to Jesse. And Jesse was passed by by Charlotte Kalla, which, you know, no surprise. And then she gets passed by another Norwegian, but Jessie thinks to herself, I can lose silver, but I'm not losing a medal for this team. So she just skis out of her mind, and they finish third. So that's how I started the book, because here's this women's relay. It's four Americans. So it's not just Keegan, who's been finishing on the World Cup podium for years, but it's four Americans who have finished on a World Cup podium. It was like the Norwegians winning the World Series or beating the Red Sox.
And they're women.
So,
I mean, I don't want to make, you know, maybe in this time I shouldn't make a big deal about that, but it seems like a common thread in your book is that they represent kind of post-Title IX maybe, or women's empowerment. I mean, they prior to Keegan, and even with Keegan, and we'll get to that, but Keegan was alone on the team for a long time, or
right,
just didn't have any peers.
Right. Right. Well, I think, I mean, how many years has it been since Title IX? I mean, this is advanced math for our tired brains. 1972. Yeah. So 46 years since Title IX. And I think, sadly, it's taken that long for us to start seeing the effects of improved opportunities for women in sports in the U.S. But it's a I think it's a major societal change in the perception of women. Like, when I was growing up, my mother did not think it was becoming of a woman to be athletic. You could be an active child, you could ski, but you couldn't sweat. To sweat was unbecoming. And what man would want to marry a sweating woman? So I think it's now become acceptable for women to be strong and muscular, and you're not perceived as either a bitch or automatically a lesbian. You know, nothing wrong with that, but if you were athletic when I was growing up, people immediately assumed you were a lesbian. And it's also become possible for women to make a career out of sports. And we saw, you know, in the previous century, men could do it. They could be football players, they could be baseball players, but you didn't see a lot of women making a living from being an athlete. We were expected to go to college and get married as soon as we could and have children.
What did you learn through the athletes that you interviewed about what that relay podium did to them in terms of confidence or their sort of presence and possibilities on the World Cup?
I think it really gave them belief. And in talking to them and in researching the book, I really realized the importance of belief in being an athlete. And, you know, you look at world-class athletes, they're probably all just about the same strength, same in, you know, aerobic capacity. But I think what separates the podium people at the front of the pack from the back are the ones who really believe they belong. So I think that relay prove to these women that they belong at the front of the World Cup. But I also think that Keegan, already having been successful, so successful on the World Cup, by then that was her first sprint globe, I think, was 2012. She won three in a row, I think, 2012, 13, and 14. And so she was already the best in the world. And I think you see a lot of times women who are that, or athletes who are that good, then separate themselves. They get their own coaches, their own entourages, and they go off and train on their own. But Keegan stayed with his team. So the women were training with her. And if you're out doing a 2-hour, 3-hour run, a roller ski with Keegan, and you think, wow, I can keep up with her on this run or this whatever they're doing, then therefore, by the associative property, if I can keep up with her here, I can keep up with her in a race. She's the best in the world, so I can keep up with the best in the world. So I think that relay and just Keegan's presence and who she was really gave these women, instilled a lot of belief.
Sounds like the book goes into a little bit of history about how women's sport, and specifically cross country, women in cross country at an elite level, evolved in the U.S. Who were some of the personalities that helped uplift women in the sport?
So I know listeners of Faster Skier are probably pretty attuned to the history of the sport, but I didn't realize, like, until I started researching this, I guess I knew it, but I didn't really realize it, that women were allowed to compete in the Olympics starting in 1952 in cross-country skiing. But the U.S. did not field a team until 1972. So here we are, this nation that's supposed to be so cutting edge, yet we're 20 years behind. So from talking to some of the icons in the sport, like John Caldwell and Marty Hall, it was the 1960s, and John had three sons and a daughter, and his daughter was skiing at Putney, and he thought it was ridiculous that there were no women competing at the world championships in the 60s. So he thought it was important to get a women's team together. So he started pulling that together along with Marty Hall. Marty was the first coach of the women's team. They fielded a world championship team in 1970 and then an Olympic team in 1972. And it was fascinating talking to Trina Hosmer about her experiences, you know, competing and making that team and, you know, going over to the Czech Republic and competing in the first world championships and being, like, pushed off the trail by the Bulgarian woman who, you know, was so much bigger and stronger than she was. And Allison Owen Bradley, was fascinating talking to her. She was a junior in 1966 or 67 had been training with the boys in Washington, and they all qualified for junior nationals. So she just went, and there was no field for girls. So there was this big to-do about whether she was going to be allowed to compete. And they agreed to let her compete, but they put an ambulance on the finish line in case she succumbed to the effort.
Oh, my gosh.
Perhaps the ambulance was there in case other people succumbed to the effort, but it was just seemed...
Wow. And so was she from the Metau, or do you know where she was from?
She's from, the Metau Valley.
Okay.
Yeah. And she lives, I believe, in Sun Valley now, in Ketchum.
Okay.
She was awesome to talk to. I mean, all these women were so great to talk to. I wish I could have talked to them all.
Wow. Because you think, 72, it's like post... is that right? Is that right? My date right?
Yeah.
It's like right when things were just in the heart of political activism.
Right. 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 And women, there was the whole, you know, freedom movement. And
yeah.
It's in my lifetime. I was born in 63. So, and I was raised to think I could do anything I wanted to do. I could ski in the backyard.
Right.
I could go to any college I wanted to. Yet, we didn't realize the hurdles that we were having to overcome.
Yeah. I guess Haight-Ashbury is a long way from like wooded ski trails.
Right.
Okay. What did you learn? It's interesting because we're talking about men who are empowering girls and women. You know, what specifically, why those individuals? I mean, it sounds like John had daughters in the game.
John had daughters in the game. I actually don't know. I should have asked Marty Hall why he was interested in coaching a women's team. He was fresh out of the University of New Hampshire, and he had a degree in physical education. He was fascinated by coaching, and he had all these good ideas. And I think had he been able to continue with his good ideas and his performance programs, a lot of what he was doing was cutting edge. And, you know, it's not cutting edge now, but it was very cutting edge then. I think the team would have really started to excel a lot sooner, but the budget was cut in the late 70s, and Marty was, you know, let go, and the program kind of plummeted into the dark ages.
Keegan, it sounds like Keegan is a real pivotal character in your book.
Yes.
And she's been a pivotal character here in Pyeongchang, elected to the IOC Athletes Commission.
Mm-hmm.
We just saw her on the television with her pink hair being sworn in, taking her Olympic oath, it sounds like, or didn't sound like it was.
Yeah, in dress clothes. I've never seen Keegan
She had jeans on. I did see that. I think she had jeans on. So talk a little bit about her. I mean, she will clearly go down as probably, if not the pivotal athlete in turning this team into a successful enterprise.
So I think Keegan is pivotal because of who she is as a person and where she was raised and her family. I spent a week up in Anchorage, and she was raised in a very large family with a lot of cousins around. So she was used to being in big groups, and she likes being in big groups. And when she... was a kid in Anchorage, she was always on team. She was on the soccer team. She was on she was skiing. She was running. She wanted to be a Division I cross country, or Division I runner, cross country and track. And then in high school, she became involved with the Nordic ski team to stay involved, to stay fit for running, and then realized she loved skiing more. But in Anchorage, the high school team was like 120 kids. It wasn't like 10 kids. So she's always been a big team person. She likes the team, you know, the rah-rah teamness, the cheering, the support, the camaraderie. So she had that experience, and she had her family's experience of competing with her family, and she's got these awesome genes, you know, from her aunt and uncle, and her mom remains the youngest winner of the Fairbanks Marathon. So she had this awesome, she had a lot of the right package
genetic
coming together.
Potential was there.
Yes. And she's very determined and very dogged, and she decided in 1998 that she wanted to be, she learned that Bill Koch was the only medal in cross-country skiing for the United States, and she wanted to win the first medal for the women because she thought women needed a medal in cross-country skiing. So she set out a 10-year plan, and nothing was going to deter her from that 10-year plan. And I asked her three times over the course of 8 months what her most trying time was in the past 20 years. It was the past 18 years at that point. And I expected her to say after Sochi when she didn't medal. And she said it was in 2005 when the U.S. ski team cut all funding for women's Nordic skiing. And she thought that that was the end of her dream. But because of the town of Anchorage, it's a city that feels like a small town, and they really rally behind their people. And she got a bunch of sponsors and people that kept her going.
Yeah, it was interesting. I thought, I'm like, boy, I mean, I would love to be, I'm not living in Anchorage, but I would love to be a fly on the wall in Anchorage when she comes home with that medal.
Yes, yes.
You know, I mean, it's going to be a big deal.
Big parade.
Yeah, and Keegan Street or whatever will be Keegan Randall Elementary School.
Right.
Ooh. Oh,
really?
Not immediately, but I imagine, I mean, in a community like that, like you say, I mean, they're 600, I don't know, they're a long way from the mainland U.S.
Yeah.
And their people are their people.
Right, right. And they, you know, they have Tuesday night race series, and it's not like, you know, in my town where five people show up. It's like, whoa, there's 100 people here every Tuesday night, and they ski and they go have beer. And
we've all, you know, interviewed and talked to Keegan covering Nordic sport, and mm-hmm. you writing a book. You know, there's been she got a lot of media attention, I'd say, in the middle part of her career in particular, because she was winning globes and she was the face of the team. And now, obviously, there's that media attention can be dispersed a bit. There's Sadie, there's Jesse, there's Sophie, there's Rosie, there's Ida.
Right.
You can go on. I'm like, am I missing anybody? I mean, there's a lot of personalities and real star athletes there. And pardon me if I missed anybody. So, yeah. I don't know.
I think there's the core seven, and then Holly, who retired and has
shout out
twins
to Holly
now.
And her husband, who actually left a positive comment for Gabby and I on the website.
Yeah, thanks, Rob.
So that said, breaking through to like who Keegan is, right? I've felt like I'm like, boy, all right, I'm getting. You know, she's coming through the mix zone, or I've called her up on the phone and I'm getting a response, and I'm like, boy, I don't feel like I've cracked the shell. And I felt like I got a little bit of a glimpse. We did a podcast interview with her a day or two after she won the medal, and she clearly was like, weight had been lifted off her shoulders and a little more effervescent.
Threw me the medal.
Yeah, she kind of threw the medal at Gabby. Nice catch. But like, who is Keegan? You know?
So I had the opportunity to talk to her mom and her dad and her aunt, Betsy, and her friends. And Keegan was the toughest nut to crack, because she does put on that, and maybe it's from years of media attention, she does put on that very professional persona. And I always did kind of want a glimpse behind the curtain to see who Keegan really is. But pretty much who you see is who you get. She's very organized. She's very business. She could be very businesslike. But she also has this fun side to her. Like, she and Tara Hamilton, who's Tara Masters now, used to dance. And I just heard the song a few minutes ago that I'm a Barbie girl in a Barbie world. I'm a Barbie girl in a Barbie world.
Do you know that song, Gabby?
Yes. So they used to crank that before high school ski races, and they'd, you know, be all pinked up and whatever. So Keegan maybe had a little bit more Jesse, has a little bit more Jesse in her than we've seen, you know, with Keegan as the professional on the World Cup circuit. But her dad, I sat down with her dad one morning and I thought, okay, this is going to be a half hour interview. Oh my God, like 2 hours later, I'm still sitting there and he's telling me just story after story, but it kind of unfolded, peeled the onion of who Keegan is and who inspired her. And but pretty much who you see with Keegan is who you get.
Okay, so I asked Keegan this, you know, and it sounded like Wickham had established a protocol of a two-way flow of information. Here's who we're thinking about being on the team, and athletes in turn pitching them and saying how they're feeling and being honest about their prospects and you know, how they might ski in that event. And, you know, I was like, Keegan, what's your intangible? Like, what is your intangible as an athlete? But I'm curious, you know, what would be your perception after researching this book and having a whole chapter on Keegan? What is her intangible in your eyes about?
I don't understand what you mean by her intangible.
Well, people talk about athletes just have this intangible gift or drive or whatever it is. They bring something to a cohort or a team that no one else can bring.
Okay. Yeah.
And it's not simply just physical capacity. Or maybe it is, but I'm just saying, like, they bring something that, and maybe Keegan brought that the other night, and another team member who might be equally as fast doesn't bring that specific intangible. Does that make sense?
Yes. So I think Keegan brings 20 years of, damn it, I set out 20 years ago with a 10-year plan to win an Olympic medal, and now it's 20 years later and I don't have an Olympic medal. I've got a son. I really want to spend time with my son and my family, and I want to go to the next chapter of my life, and I want this to end the way I intended it to end. And you could see that the last time she charged up the wall and she was starting to fall back and we're like, oh no, and she kicked something in. It was that extra gear. And I think it was that. It was the 20 years of, I set out to do this and damn it, I'm going to prove myself right.
Yeah, that was amazing. Like this, where we were all watching the race, you could see that head wall. And it's true. I mean, you could see it in Jesse. You could see it in Keegan. You thought, oh gosh, they're going to fall. I mean, that's a steep, burly climb. That just gets steeper.
Except Keegan wouldn't say, damn it. I said, damn it.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever
Gosh,
heard.
Darn it.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. I would have said something worse. But it was amazing to see them just latch on.
Yeah.
Okay, then there's this other guy who wears this Red Sox hat all across Europe, Matt Wickham. What did you learn about Matt? I mean, there's a lot of, and I mean this with respect. I mean, Matt pays a lot of lip service to the concept of team, as do all the athletes. Mm-hmm. Whether it's truly like that or not, that's what they're putting forward to the media. Talk a little bit about Matt and what he, brought to this team, where they're not just Keegan. Now you've got a bunch of other personalities. Oh, and Liz. I don't know if I mentioned Liz in that list of skiers.
Right.
We're huge Liz fans here, actually. She's always been,
Yeah, she's fun. Great.
Yeah. So, you have to be a personality manager.
Yes. So Matt, first of all, when you meet Matt, he talks to you as if he's known you his entire life and you are his best friend, which is an unusual quality, I think. But Matt is another key person on this team. And I learned a lot about Matt by talking to his first coach, a man named Ed Hamill down in Western Mass. And you have to know Matt. I mean, he's this great guy. He could be in GQ magazine now. But as a kid, he was, and I was a kid with glasses and braces and a total geek. He was a quiet, geeky kid. And if you see some of his,
really?
He posted a picture on Facebook where he's got the mullet, and the big hair and the.
Really?
Yeah.
Pull that up. Let's Google.
I'm dying to get that photo.
Quiet, socially awkward kid. And I talked to his best friend, who's also named Matt, and he was like, yeah, he was just this kid who, we were the geeks. We were the kids. We were not the cool people. So Matt gets involved with this Bill Koch program that the Hamels, Ed and Mary Hamill, have started. And Ed Hamill, he just had it in his mind that he wasn't just going to coach skiing. He was going to have this sort of kids program where every weekend it was some adventure, and it was an adventure that they all had to get through together. And whether it was like running the length of the Holyoke Range and figuring out how to get across the Connecticut River without using a bridge, or running up this mountain, going straight up this cliff, you have to figure out how to get not just yourself up there, but everybody on the team, including the little kids. So Matt grew up with this idea that it's not just you, it's you helping everybody else coming along. So he was a pretty good high school cross-country ski racer, and then he went to Stratton Mountain School for a year in the Middlebury and became the team captain up there. And I think he sort of started coming out of his shell, and maybe just for maturity, and he started talking to people more. And developed into an amazing coach. And I think he is such a good coach because it's his personality. He grew up with he has a sister and a brother. So I think he's a middle kid. So you just have to learn how to get along with people and how to work as a team.
Middle kid.
Yeah.
That's a huge, I mean, I'm married to
a
middle child.
I think he's a middle kid. I'll have to check.
Well, let's pretend he is. But I think there's a lot of merit to that hypothesis. No, the middle kid, they're like diplomats.
They are.
So without Matt, does any of this happen?
I don't know. That's a good question. I mean, Chris Grover has a lot of the similar qualities. They're both very humble, quiet, intelligent, introspective men. But I think that when they decided in 2011 to focus specifically on a women's team and putting Matt as the head of that, I think that was key. Because you pull these women apart, you make them into a team, not just the whole greater team with the men, even though the men are part of it too. But yeah, that's a good question. I think Matt is key. You need a personality like Matt.
Yeah. Team what?
Sorry, just giggling.
No, what was that? Team crush?
Yeah.
Like, what do you mean by that? Like a crush is like real?
Yeah. You know.
Like Matt. Matt, you mean? Yeah, he's a good looking dude.
Yeah, he is.
Yeah.
I mean, imagine him with a mullet. And
well, I actually
hair.
Was just about to say that, the 1090 or the business in the front, party in the back, Matt, from Western
yeah.
Mass.
Yeah.
In all honesty, yeah, when you were describing
exactly.
that, I was like, dudes who have
kind
mullets.
Kind of geeky, you know, smart enough to go to Middlebury.
They didn't seem, the few that I knew that have mullets, they seem to be a little more, you got to be a little confident to rock that.
Maybe, or you're just trying to fit in.
Maybe,
yeah.
or clueless.
And I did not know this until this Olympics.
Sorry,
when
Matt, we're just trying
somebody,
to flesh out.
His prom date posted this picture on Facebook, and he's got on a tuxedo where he's cut the sleeves off.
Oh, wow. And he's like, how old? Is he late 30s?
Late 30s.
Okay. Maybe I'll call him up and get the backstory to add on to this one. Okay. And more recently, I mean, all of this obviously blends into more recent history and tons of media attention. And I would assert that, you know, sometimes people say, well, faster skier projects the pressure, or the general ski community projects the pressure about getting medals. But I do feel like, and I talked to, gosh, see, I can't even remember.
I know.
I just spoke to him. Who'd we interview?
TK?
TK. Tom Kelly. We talked to Tom Kelly. We did a long interview, which will be posted at some point. You know, we talked about that tension between the U.S. ski team overhyping and putting pressure on these athletes and the reality of the competition. And so I remember you were in Lahti covering the team and still working on your book, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, on paper, you looked at it, and I think up to that time they hadn't placed better than fourth in maybe a year, I think.
In the relay?
Yeah, in the
relay.
Yeah,
and that was their third fourth place finish at a world championship in the relay.
At Lahti,
yeah.
Yeah, and so I remember, you know, looking at the statistics prior to the race, I'm like, wow, I mean, it'll be a good day if they can get fourth.
Right.
And I think talking to Chris Grover at the time, and I forget if this was before or after, but I'm thinking it was after the race, that statistically, yeah, fourth was probably
pretty
optimistic.
Good. Yeah. Yeah.
But, like, what was your sense coming into Lahti and then coming out of Lahti about, you know, the pressure put on them and who was putting the pressure on them and the realistic, or how that might actually realistically play out?
Well, I think, you know, they all said that they, and Matt particularly has said this over and over again, that they didn't need the medal. Like, they're proud enough of what they've created that they didn't need the medal. But I think, you know, they can feel that internally, but it's really nice to be validated by that medal. So I think they really wanted the validation, or maybe we wanted the validation for them. It's hard to decide. But I remember talking to Liz after the relay, and, you know, I expected them to be a little devastated. And Liz was like, you know what? This fourth was great, and I don't need a medal to show that what I've done in the past 20 years of my life is worth it. Like, what we've created on this team is enough of a gold medal for me. And I started looking around at the other teams in the relay. Like, the Canadians came through, they had ribbons in their hair.
Yeah, they were pretty
The
stoked.
Swedes came through, they had flag tattoos on their cheeks. So you could see the impact that the American women have had on the World Cup field, the Women's World Cup field. And I think at that point, they were taking a lot of pride in that. And I was hoping in Lahti that they would medal in the relay, but as you said, I think fourth was pretty realistic. They needed a perfect day at that point to win a medal, and I think they've come up another little bit of the step from that. Coming to the Olympics, I think it was the same thing. I think the media was putting a lot of pressure on them. Our perception, like, we as media needed a good story. We need, like, oh, biathlon's never medaled. U.S. women's cross country has never medaled. We need this story because we need something fresh to write about. But, yeah, it is a great story. But I think they would have been content leaving here if Jesse had never done anything better than fifth in skiathlon.
Yeah.
I think they would have left here content with, like, wow, we're really improving.
I agree.
But that's just my perception.
No, I agree. I mean, I think I asked that question in the press conference. I'm like, boy, were you feeling pressure? Because I think to that point, when they won the gold, she already had three fifths and a sixth.
Yeah.
Something like
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
Which is outstanding.
Right.
You know, it's in particular, it's outstanding when you look at the, you know, maybe the only name that's missing is a Johaug
right.
serving
right.
A doping violation.
Right.
So, I mean, it's
they was heavy hitters
deal.
Out there, yeah.
Yeah. So one of the things that's, you know, coming into the games, and I have a friend who's the, he's, now he worked at the Wall, Matt Futterman, he worked at the Wall Street, you know Matt.
Yeah, I know Matt.
Yeah, so Matt was a writer for the sports reporter for the Wall Street Journal for a long time. Now he's a deputy sports editor for the Times, which has done awesome coverage here over the course of the games. And I know he just has always been interested in endurance sport in
mm-hmm.
particular. You know, he's really enjoyed covering the U.S. cross country team. But you know, in talking to a lot of the mainstream journalists here, it's like everyone was just waiting. You know, it's like the medal story was, they were all pre-written.
Right.
And they were just, every night I'd see them there and they'd kind of look over and be like,
right.
What do we do with that draft?
Right. And yep. I had to do the same thing because I have to have my breaking newses.
Right.
And you just, I mean, again, it was the press, it was us needing a story that would get clicks, that would get eyeballs. And a story about Jesse finishing fifth in a skiathlon is a huge deal, but not if you're a middle-aged mom in Manhattan who, you know, doesn't know anything about cross-country skiing. But, you know, the first medal ever in cross-country skiing is a big deal. So I think we needed that for our readership.
Yeah, and that's such an interesting tension. I mean, I know we're getting a little bit off-topic, but that for me, that's always like, faster skier people, I'm hoping, get the fact that the medal doesn't really, I mean, I guess it validates, but with even without the medal, I don't think it's any less of an accomplishment what's happened, even for the guys.
Yeah. I mean, Scott Patterson's 11th yesterday, best since Bill Koch.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
And Simi and Eric, I mean, in reality, they are like, they are in the hunt.
Yes, they are. Yep.
Okay, so a couple of things that, you know, what did you learn about the obstacles that have been present and may still be present for young girls and women in playing sport? Like, what did you learn about the obstacles that might be out there that you maybe weren't aware of prior to writing the book?
Well, I learned there were a lot of obstacles when I was a kid in high school in the late 70s and early 80s. I'd like to think that we've overcome some of those obstacles. Like, I didn't have, there were mostly male coaches back then. And I think men were, there were the coaches who were used to coaching men. And I mean, when I was in college, most of my close friends were men. So I didn't really think there was much difference between men and women. But I've come to realize that there's a big difference between how you coach men and how you coach women, and how women respond best to what kind of coaching or what kind of feedback we respond best to. Where men seem to be a little bit more, you can kind of, not taunt men, but men seem to leave more of it on the playing field, and you can kind of spur them on, where women really need to be sort of encouraged and built up a little bit. And maybe that would be good for men too. I don't know.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, my own 14-year-old, or now 15, I would be like, oh, he falls more into the, you know, that female type.
Right.
Yeah, like how.
And maybe it's just a personality thing, but.
Yeah.
I've learned that there are different ways that you coach men and coach women. And like, I took up tennis 10 years ago. I just wanted something new to learn. And I've got this awesome tennis pro where I learned to play. And he's like Matt Wickham, and he's so encouraging. And he'll tell you the 10 things that you're doing right before he'll tell you the one thing that you need to do to improve what you're doing. And it just builds you up and makes you feel like you're like, wow, I can do this. I'm not the loser I think I am. What other hurdles are there? I think in cross country, in endurance sports for women in general, there are still financial hurdles. Do people still perceive women being athletic as unappealing? I don't know. I like to think not. So I think those are the main, I'm sure I'm forgetting something with my tired brain, but.
And so some of the things maybe that you learned, you know, again, repeating, a lot of the spin put forward is always team this, team that. And although I think we all buy into that, and clearly the athletes buy into that as well, it's still in many ways an individual sport, you know?
Right, it is.
What did you learn, you know, exploring the book about how actually they are individuals and they aren't so subservient to the ethos of like team first?
Well, they, as a group, and they're a very closed group, it's like a family, and they're not going to tell you the family secrets. They didn't tell me what the team tensions were, but there was some allusion. They did allude to the year that Keegan was, that she took off the World Cup because she was pregnant. There was a little bit of a void left, and without that default leader, like the person who'd been on the team the longest, the person who was getting the best results, she was automatically the team leader. So without her around, you know, Jessie was doing really well. She was suddenly getting all those World Cup podiums consistently every weekend. Then, you know, there were people like Liz who'd been on the team for 10 years, and then there were, you know, newer people, and, you know, everybody has a different role on the team. So who became the team leader? Do you need a team leader? And I think without Matt, and Matt said that was the year he kind of, you know, he stepped back a little bit more than he said he should have. And I think what you really need to keep the team working cohesively is a constant hand on the tiller and somebody constantly making sure that you're having team meetings and grievances and frustrations and insecurities are aired and people understand what's going on with their teammates. I think that can keep your team on a positive track. But as soon as little insecurities start festering or jealousy start festering, then everything starts fraying at the edges.
Okay. Anything else we should ask?
I'm so tired. Did I answer that correctly?
You did. I mean, yeah. I mean, because everyone wants to know dirt, right? It's like a little bit of like, what?
You know, right.
Come on. It can't be all USA stars and stripes and glitter.
But even if there is dirt on this team, and I'm sure there is, I mean, we've all got dirt.
Yeah.
They are such a closed team, and it's so part of their team environment that they're going to protect that dirt and take it to their graves.
Sure.
Because that's not who this team is.
Okay. Favorite moment from the last 2-3 weeks here in South Korea?
Favorite moment, you have to ask?
Well, I don't know. Yeah.
I get watching that relay. Oh, God, I like get choked up thinking about it.
Yeah,
you know?
Exciting.
Or not relay. Oh, my gosh, watching that team sprint. I keep calling
it
a relay.
It's, in a way, it's funny because I think I had to, like, delete that word out of my draft.
Yeah.
Because it seems like a relay because they are tagging off
right,
to each other.
Right.
Yeah. Hey, Fisk, come up with a better word to describe
team
that.
Sprint.
I'm sorry.
Right.
Team sprint relay. I don't know. It's confusing.
And then listening, I went, Krista, Case Bryan, and I sprinted, literally sprinted. I thought I was going to cough up a lung to the medal ceremony. And listening, like watching them as they played the Star Spangled Banner, that was pretty cool.
We were freezing over in the Biofon venue. Is that what
happened? Had my heart hit.
That was a good night in Biofon, actually. Yeah, it was a good race.
I feel badly for the biathletes. They really deserve their day in the sun too.
They do. And it's interesting. I mean, they were so the women's relay, I mean, they were in the medal hunt up until, you know, they were in the medal hunt very late.
Yeah.
And the guys too. I mean, the guys had their best match, the best finish since 1972, I think.
something like that.
That
circles back to that. I think we all probably know this covering the sport, but that everybody is gunning for the Olympics. It's not just like the U.S. Right. women or the guys are coming right. in trying to peak right. for this. You know, Ivo Niskanen yesterday in his press conference, he won the men's 50K. He talked about it. He essentially is focused on the two races, the 15K Classic in Lahti, which he won at World Champs, mm-hmm. and this race for 2 years.
Right, and I think you've seen that like in the past few Olympics, because I cover the Summer Games too. We've seen this almost embarrassment of riches with the U.S. winning so many medals that you almost become kind of immune to, like, oh, another medal, yeah. But it became apparent here, like, whoa, everybody is trying to win a medal. You know, no matter what country you're from, you're trying to win a medal.
So seeing Belarus win the women's relay and biathlon and how excited they were, but I was like, okay, in doing that background research, I think they had, you know, podium before, but it's cool. It's like, it's not, you know, Norway,
right.
it's not Germany, which had been dominant over in biathlon. So, well, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Thank you. It's been fun spending 3 weeks with you guys and getting to know you.
Yeah, it's good. It's always nice to be like, okay, there's a familiar face and someone who knows the sport.
And I have to say, FasterSkier.com, you guys cover, you are tireless in your coverage, and you really helped me research this book. And I put that in the acknowledgments at the end, how important you guys, and I know from being in this business that it is work that you do not get thanked for financially. So just know that you helped one person in this world, at least. You know, the New York Times and the Washington Post, like all the big guys, always get kind of thanked, and they're the first ones that the athletes go to, NBC, USA Today.
Sure.
And it's like, no, you guys are doing the down and dirty, regular, every week coverage, and I think that needs to be acknowledged and thanked.
All right, well, thanks again.
Thanks.
Appreciate it.
Yeah, safe travels home.
Before we end in our quest for the truth, here's the background on Matt Whitcomb's hairstyle of choice back in middle school and his early high school years.
I did roll with a mullet for a large part of my high school and middle school years.
Really?
Yeah, you know, it was a safe way to go. You never had to check your mirrors or look behind you because you were covered back there. It just felt kind of good. And it was, people ask why we did that. I honestly don't know. I just think it's what we did. I can remember sitting down at the barber though, and they would say, how do you want this done? I just said, I don't really care. Just don't touch the back. And that's how a mullet grows, turns out.
Like the back was totally precious to you.
Yeah.
Like don't mess with it.
I don't want that altered in any way. It's perfect. So,
like through middle school through most of high school, is that right?
Yeah, I'd say probably I started to experience some haircut pressures probably in 9th or 10th grade, and the mullet started to shorten up into more of a normal haircut, and then it just turned out that I have a terrible head of hair in the end, so that was as good as it was ever going to get.
All right, your hair looks fine. So, all right, so and did that, I guess my follow-up question would be, like, you seem like a super well-adjusted adult. like, the mullet, like, and I brought this up in my conversation with Peggy. I was a little surprised. I was like, wow, okay, mullet. I didn't peg you as a mullet guy, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it's hard for me to think about that as well. I was a pretty insecure middle schooler, and that was, like, my comfort haircut, and I don't know, perhaps as I became a little bit more secure as an 11th and 12th grader, could kind of lighten the load back there and wear something a little more vulnerable. But yeah, that's how it was.
Wow. No, nothing says like non-vulnerable like a mullet.
Okay. Right. All right. It makes me want to grow it out again, since that's the only place on my head that actually produces good hair anymore.
There's a slight, like, I don't know what they call it, if it's receding from the front. I don't know. I Googled Matt Whitcomb US ski team mullet and there's nothing evident, but there is in fact a recent photo, and it might even be the one because I just went to images, and so I guess I could visit the site, but I think it might be your official US ski team photo.
Oh, could be
from this year. Because you have that like new white jacket
on. Yes, with quite a beard, maybe. Yeah.
That is right. Okay.
Yeah, you gotta grow it where you have it. You know, it doesn't grow on top anymore. So.
Thanks for listening to Nordic Nation.